To all who come to this happy place, welcome.
I'm not sponging for rum. It be gold I'm after.
Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-hey.
There's no turning back now.
Like a grand and miraculous spaceship, our planet has sailed through the universe of time.
Stupid Judy, stupid energy.
Launch us now!
Chef, everything okay?
Later, hop and hop under, machine in his go under, floody, floody.
Exactly.
Something has gone wrong.
Thank you for flying Star Tours. Bye-bye.
You made it! I knew you would.
We're penguins. We can fly.
Friends, I celebrate your arrival. If you drink too much from the fountain of youth, we will be happy to assist you with strollers.
Welcome to the cutest little town in Carburetor County.
Remain seated, please.
Permanecer sentados, por favor.
Hi, hello, and welcome. Welcome to our show.
Welcome to the WDW News Today podcast, a variety show dedicated to the Walt Disney World Resort in Orlando, Florida, and the Disneyland Resort in Anaheim, California. Bridging the gaps between you and the Disney World, here is your host, Tom Corliss.
Welcome to another edition of the WDWNT podcast. This is episode 319 for April 1st, 2014. On this week's show, we continue our countdown of the 25 biggest moments in the history of Disney's Hollywood studios as voted by you, with moments 13, 12, and 11 on the countdown. We'll see where you rank them and where our illustrious panel thinks they should be in our countdown to the 25th anniversary of Disney's Hollywood studios. All this and more Walt Disney World information and fun awaits you this week on the WDW News Today podcast.
In honor of the historic 25th anniversary of Disney's Hollywood Studios, the WDW News Today podcast proudly presents its greatest production to date, the 25 biggest moments in the history of Disney's Hollywood Studios. Please welcome your host for this spectacular journey into the movies, director Tom Corliss. Hollywood, here we come.
Lights, camera, and action. Welcome to our continuing countdown of the 25 biggest moments in the history of Disney's Hollywood studios, as voted by you. Joining me for the segment, David Smith.
Hello, hello, hello.
Zach Larson.
Hey, I'm back. Best didn't even notice I was gone.
I think people did.
Yeah.
And Jason Niffendall.
Hey, howdy, hey.
So, as usual with these segments, we are again counting down the 25 biggest moments in the history of Hollywood Studios, counting down to its 25th anniversary on May 1st. And what we do in these segments is we reveal several moments where they've been placed on the list by you, and then our illustrious panel tells you where they have them on their list as they rank them, and whether or not you did a good job ranking them. It's a segment essentially where we insult you, but you seem to like it, so we're going to keep doing it. So anyway, this week we're going to be leading up to the final 10. We're going to do moments 13, 12, and 11 on the countdown. And so we're getting very close to the anniversary. And Jason, speaking of the anniversary, what's going on at WW Celebration?
Well, I can tell you that we have recently released a bit of teaser info about our new interactive game. Those of you who've done one of our events before may have done one of our scavenger hunts or future world quest or other interactive games, and we're always coming up with new ideas for these games. And so on Saturday, May 3rd, the third day of the event, we've got an all-day game. It starts at 10 o'clock in the morning and ends at 6 o'clock at night. This is the longest game we've ever done, and it's going to be something rather unique, somewhat different than anything we've done in the past. So that's our newest bit of news that we have out there. We've tweaked the schedule a bit and things along those lines. We probably would actually have tickets on sale for the group dinner at Cape May Cafe by the time you're hearing this. So, there's a bit more information in the schedule on our website at www.celebrations.com, and that's also where you can go to register for the event.
And the event, by the way, is Studio 25, a celebration of the 25th anniversary of the studio. Just in case people
that is
are
correct.
Wondering. They're fun fan events. If you haven't been to one before, they're really great, and you should. But anyway, I digress. We have a bit of history to get through, so let's start our countdown. Let's go with number 13, if I could have a dramatic drum roll, please.
Nope. Zach, that's you.
Oh, wait, nobody took over for me on this one?
Nope, it's been silent.
We did, in one case we did, but we did it so poorly we gave up.
Very poor imitations, yes.
Well, you couldn't just loop one of my old ones from the Epcot
segment?
That
would require effort. Moment number 13, 2006, the Osborne Family Spectacle of Dancing Lights premiered.
Woohoo!
Not to be confused with the Osborne Family Spectacle of Lights.
That don't dance.
No, they were not dancing. They were sticks in the mud. But anyway, in 2004, the park began construction on a new arena for its upcoming Lights, Motors, Action Extreme Stunt Show. Only if we can go back and warn them. That was set to open. We need to get in the DeLorean from Back to the Future, and we need to cross segments here. It was set to open in 2005. So part of the construction included the demolition of Residential Street. Get out your handkerchiefs, everyone. Thus necessitating another move of the display. And the solution was to move it to another part of the park. And the only available part of the park that really made sense to them was New York Street. And this is apparently this big set, which was then going to be known as Streets of America. They were doing a bit of an expansion and redesign at the time. And so they decided Streets of America and New York Street are going to be the new home for the Spectacle of Lights. And as part of the move, the studios added an artificial snow effect to this display, made up to 33 snow machines that use 100 gallons of fluid per evening. And so the 2006 edition rolled around, and the park added over 1,500 dimmer relay circuits and control switches to the display to enable the lights to dim on and off electronically. The relays were choreographed to musical score, and the display was given its new name, the Osborne Family Spectacle of Dancing Lights. So the first year they moved to the Streets of America, they did not dance. They were not ready for it. It was just a static display. It was kind of meh. And they decided, we got to do something. Look at what all these... Look on YouTube at what these people are doing with their homes. They're programming their lights to music. Which, by the way, right here down the street, there's some house that does that. And it's a very small display, yet they've programmed it to music. So it was something average people were starting to figure out. And Disney's like, well, look at the size of this display. Why are we not doing it here? And so they resolved that in 2006 and made the display what it is now. And, hard to argue it. It's never been more popular.
Kind of like they did with Lights of Winter. Oh, oops.
Danced right out of the park. So where does everybody have this?
Personally, I put this at 17. Because it allowed them, I guess, more space to do more with the lights that they had. But at the same time, it also created a crowd-controlled nightmare.
Yeah,
that exists to this day, and I think for that very reason, I didn't put it higher on my list.
Unfortunately, Zach, that crowd-controlled nightmare is called Disney's Hollywood Studios.
Well, you know, but the fact is that, and the cast members do their best, but requiring you to enter only in one area. And they wanted, it seems like they want to make it into like a gigantic cul-de-sac where you go down and you turn back or you go down and then you come out the other end. But the problem is that everyone just kind of stands in one spot and then tries to eat the snowflakes and then realize, oh, wait, no, this is, soap. And it's, I think it's probably more nostalgia than anything else, but I miss it being on a street of houses. Probably because I never lived in New York City. I've always lived in the suburbs, so I can relate to that a bit more. But yeah, that's, number 17 for me.
I also had it at 17. Although I'm not quite as negative about the crowd control issues, I think you would have hit that even on residential street as it became more popular.
I mean, Cinderella Castle gets quite a bottleneck these days just for the castle lights. So it's,
right.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess the only reason I had it at 17 was I thought there were 16 other things that were more important. But I really like what they did with this by turning it into a dancing light spectacle, and I think it really adds a lot. I think you really can't, overstate the emotional impact that this event has on everybody as they come into the park. It's really made Hollywood Studios kind of a central point for the holiday season for a lot of people. Between that and the Magic Kingdom, those are the two points you absolutely have to hit.
Yeah, outside of the Christmas party, absolutely. And it's a free offering compared to the Christmas party, so it's included with your park admission.
I had this at number 23, so a bit lower.
Quite a bit lower. Almost off the list.
Almost off the list. You know, this, in my mind, this was an incremental improvement over the non-dancing lights, which, you can argue was an incremental improvement over the lights from Residential Street. Last time I talked to Bea Arthur, she was homeless. So wow. I think that...
Last time, yes. I talked to her, she was
dead. Come on, stop picking on poor Maude.
I think this was neat. It certainly was something that Disney kind of needed to do. They recognized that the technology existed, and they kind of needed to do this to keep up with, the state of the art in Christmas light displays. But I don't think it deserves to be super high because, like I said, in my mind, it was an incremental improvement. People would have come to the spectacle of lights no matter what. And, they might not have been as excited about it, or they might not have been as awed by it, but they would have come anyway. And so this was, this was, in Walt's term, just plussing the experience. It wasn't anywhere near as significant as, a new attraction opening or anything like that. And that's why I put it fairly far down on the list. I do like the lights that dance. I think that part of the crowd control nightmare that Zach talked about is specifically because the lights dance. When the lights didn't dance, you could look at the lights and keep moving. And that's pretty much what people did down Residential Street. You strolled down the street and looked at the lights, and then you were done.
Yeah.
With the lights dancing, people want to see, the full track of songs that they have set up for the lights dancing. And they want to see it in from different perspectives and different places within the entire area. And so that creates the bottleneck because people don't move. They're not ready to move. They move every once in a while as opposed to of strolling through.
I think generally people stop and watch a song and then they just sort of move along. So I think it stops for a song, but then you move on to the next
then
song.
Then I think
and
they move along.
People.
Yeah, but then they might. They might move along and stop at the next song at a next spot. It's certainly, I don't think you can argue that people spend more time there now that the lights dance than they did before.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's a lot of the problem with the crowd control nightmare. It is a crowd control nightmare. It's almost like they need to build in an omni-mover to keep people moving through this thing. Because there are people that are just staying there for, an hour or more.
You know what they could do? They could rip out the stage at Lightsporters Action, and you could watch the show from the 5,000 bleachers.
It would finally fill the bleachers.
Yeah.
How about they don't rip out the stage, but they just put the dancing lights on the Streets of France backdrop
on the cars
of Lice Motors Action and the cars.
As long as they cover the cars with lights.
I do think that overall, you know, not necessarily the dancing lights, but the lights themselves from the get go have really turned studios into a destination, as you said, for the holidays. This is what, you know, this is to studios what Food and Wine is to Epcot. It's what people talk about. It's what people plan trips around to go see. And for that, it's really put studios on the map as a must-see park, you know, during the holiday season. It certainly is, you know, people talk about the castle lighting and stuff and how that jams up, you know, the hub. This is so much more than the castle lighting. It's just not on the castle, but still, you know, this is much more awe-inspiring than the castle lighting ceremony. And, you know, that's why I think people stand there and just watch for an hour or more, because they're just in awe at the whole thing.
Yeah, I have this at 13 where the listeners have it. I think this is important because, honestly, I don't remember Osborne being a huge deal before they started dancing. I remember seeing it at Streets of America thinking, oh, it's... Or Residential Street, I should say, and being, oh, okay, it's cute. Yeah, all right, let's go do rides. And I think once, and even like the year they started dancing, we were going, I was like, you know, it's a nice little display. We're going to studios anyway. And then they did the dancing, and they went, wow, I really like this now. And I really loved Osborne since then. I really was not a fan before that. I think it's made a huge difference. I think you see studios attendance, you know, years since then at the holidays. Considering, you know, 2006 is still a time where studios wasn't doing great. And yet they were doing big crowds holiday season because the Osborne lights were dancing and people thought it was really cool. I think it's a big deal. I think 13's about right. And I know that might sound a little crazy for an event that takes place a whole two and a half months of the year, but... I think it's that important. So anyway. So that will bring us to moment number 12. If I could have a drum roll, please. 1991 Muppet Vision 3D opens!
Yay!
I was waiting for it. So, Muppet Vision 3D... was the first in-park collaboration between the wonderful people over at Henson and the Disney Company, and it was actually the last thing Jim Henson worked on in his life. And it was rushed into production once the MGM Studios park opened, as they needed more attractions, and Muppets was one of the first things they started working on, and finally it would open in May of 1991. And it has been entertaining guests there ever since. Of course, over the years, not much has changed. It has gone digital, which is a big deal. It looks very pretty now. But beyond that, it is still delighting guests. It has been cloned for California Adventure, where it's also still running, even though several occasions where people believed it was not going to return after it was used as movie previews. But regardless, Muppet Vision 3D continues to be a staple of Disney's Hollywood studios, where it doesn't seem like it's ever going to go away.
And that's good.
Yeah, and if you want the full history of this attraction, we've done a Back to the Future on it. It was very long. You should go listen to that.
There were a lot of quotes.
There were a lot of quotes. Up, Chuck.
Did you say cheap three-day twat?
Anyway, I put this one at number 13, so pretty much right in the same area. It was a very important attraction at the time because, A, it brought an attraction to a park that desperately needed attractions. B, it was that big collaboration between the Walt Disney Company and the Jim Henson Company that, you know, some would say laid the groundwork for the acquisition of the Muppet characters by the company. But also because it's just a really good attraction that holds up even today. There's a lot of attractions that don't hold up 25 years, that don't hold up 10 years. Muppet Vision is not one of those attractions. It's a great attraction. However, if you look at just the grand scheme of the park, it doesn't quite strike me. And this is from a big Muppet fan. I own two Muppets. But in the grand scheme of the entire park, it just didn't strike me as being as vital to the existence or the history of the park. It's just a really great addition, but not necessarily something that was really vital. Just important, not vital. So that's where I put it, where I did. Kind of pretty close to where everyone else put it.
See, now that's interesting, because I put it at 12, which was right where the listeners put it and right next to where you put it. But I would have to disagree with the fact that this is not a vital attraction to the park. I think that, you know, opening 2 years after the park did, it was kind of in the first wave of additions. It certainly helped the park to become, more of a half day park than it was. Maybe now it's like a 5/8 park day park or something. I don't know. But
an hour and a half after lunch park.
But I think this really was a pretty significant attraction for the simple reason that, you know, each park has its 3D attraction, and this one has outlasted many, many others. You know, people never get tired of the Muppets and their, you know, antics and their practical jokes. And I think that, you know, the Muppets have really withstood the test of time very well. And, you know, the fact that this is 23 years later, it's still there and it still draws a healthy crowd.
I think it's officially the longest running 3D theme park attraction.
I wouldn't doubt that at all, because I mean, Epcot's rotated a number, Magic Kingdom has rotated a number, and Animal Kingdom hasn't been open long enough.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing in Animal Kingdom, it's got 7 years on its stuff to be a bug, but still.
Right. Yep.
And that's only there because they can't get rid of it.
Sure.
Well, I mean,
it does well.
I don't think it does as well as Muppet Vision.
No, it doesn't, but it does well.
And Muppet Vision, you know, being much older, drawing more than it's tough to be a bug, says something about the longevity of the Muppets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it really was a significant addition to the park, and it remains a significant attraction in the park. You know, Lights, Motors, Action has a seating area 62 times as big and still has less people than Muppet Vision on a daily basis. So it's,
you know,
it tells you right there.
Well, see, here's the thing is, and I looked at this from the perspective of not necessarily a Muppet fan, because that would, I feel that would skew my opinion, but I at least in 2014, I would group Muppet Vision in along with an attraction such as, like, you know, almost to a certain degree, like the Enchanted Tiki Room, in that, yeah, it was groundbreaking and important at a time, but there, like, but as time progressed, yes, people are still going to go there, and people are still going to, I guess, render honors to it, because either they're a Muppet fan or because they feel that it's kind of, you know, a big deal from their childhood or from, you know, from when they grew up. But, you know, your average family that visits the Hollywood studios now is not going to go be like, oh, wow, you know, oh, I can't believe there's a Muppet 3D movie here. They're going to go like, oh, there's a Muppet attraction. You want to go check that out? It's at a walk-on. So, I mean, that's why I didn't put it higher, but you know, I mean, at least that's the justification for why I said what I said. So
you may have a point there, Zach, and I think, you know, going back just 2 or 3 years, that was definitely the case. But my hope is that with the new movies that are being produced, that people are having a little bit more organic interest in this type of attraction, and this attraction mm-hmm. in particular. I mean, I had it at number 10 simply because of its longevity. And the fact that even though it's been around so long, it's still, you know, it's familiar, but it doesn't feel dated. It doesn't feel like it's old. You know, it does. I almost disagree with your statement about it being like Tiki Room, whereas, you know, Tiki Room, I have to respect it because it was one of the early attractions, but I don't necessarily enjoy it. You know what I'm saying? Whereas Muppet Vision 3D, even though I've seen it a ton of times, I still do enjoy that show, and I'm still eager to go back there. I think what disappoints me to some degree is that it feels like the whole Muppet franchise is a missed opportunity in the parks. Now, we know that Disney can do bad Muppet shows because they did that previous to this. And so the fact that this one was good is definitely great, but I felt like there could have been more, and they were planning more. It just never really got off the drawing board, and that I'm a little bit sad about.
But now the Muppets are a profitable film franchise. Well, at least that's until Muppets Most Wanted hits theaters. But anyway. is everyone else gone?
Yeah, no, I think, Dave, I think you're right, and you've got a really good point there, that Muppet Vision really is genuinely entertaining. And the Tiki Room is neat, it's nostalgic, but you can argue that it's not quite genuinely entertaining.
It's kind of like this show.
It's kind of like this show. It's really not entertaining at all.
No.
There's loudmouth birds arguing back and forth. Just like
some really bad singing, yeah.
I think Muppet Vision certainly is genuinely entertaining, and it's an attraction when you compare it to Tiki Room. I will see Muppet Vision on average more than I will see Tiki Room in any given trip or any given day or whatever. You know, I'm liable to skip Tiki Room for a trip, but I wouldn't skip Muppet Vision for a trip. So, you know, in that respect, you do make a valid point.
Also, there's a park that has 40 attractions versus a park that has 7. So, I don't know if that's really a compliment for Muppets. You kind of have to do it if you're spending a day there. But I understand what you're saying. I have Muppet Vision at 10. There's only so many attractions that have opened in the history of this park, so I think when one opens, it's important. That being said, Muppet Vision is incredibly important. It is the birth of the modern 3D theme park attraction. It was the first one to tie in audio animatronics and in-theater effects and all of these things together, which some of the things are still so novel, no one else has really tried them. Like, you have animatronics behind you, and there's a cannon that comes out, and the theater explodes. There's just a lot going on here, and so much of it was original and creative, and so much of it, even by Disney for other 3D shows they would make, was copied and copied and copied again and again. So many of the gags from this. I think so. Historically, as far as theme park attractions go, this is incredibly important. 3D shows are a staple of every sort of theme and amusement park of all kinds of sizes and budgets. Beyond that, for this park, it's important because it's one of the few attractions. It's a franchise that people love. It's a very high quality attraction that most, you know, every guest will agree. It's very well written, put together, very funny, entertaining, unique. I just think this attraction has a lot going for it. And I think that's why I would put it at 10. Obviously, it's not as important as you know, several other attractions we'll talk about as this list goes on, but you can't discount how important this show is. And the interesting thing is, and again, you put it in any other park, it might not even be that important. And California Adventure comes to mind, where I think if we did a list of however old that park is, that many moments, Muppet Vision opening with the park probably wouldn't be on there. Also, Muppet Vision, again, was a big part of the capacity additions for the park. They took away what was backlot tour area and built a new area for guests on the side of New York Street, and it was a fairly big expansion area for the park as far as where guests can walk. So there's a lot of reasons for Muppet Vision to be here, and I think very important attraction, wonderful attraction again, all of which can be heard in whatever Back to the Future segment that was where we did Muppet Vision.
I think it's in the 190s.
Yeah, it's actually in the... I think we did it as part of the countdown of the 20 biggest moments. We did it for the 40 moments. That's right. Yeah. It actually made the 40 moments list for Walt Disney World. So it's somewhere in 2011 we did that. But it's a great segment. And certainly more said there than we have time to say in this particular segment. All right. Well, let's move on then to moment number 11. The song. 2001, Walt Disney, One Man's Dream opens.
Yee-hoo!
Yay.
Where do I get out? How do I get out? Where's the exit? Crap, I have to watch the movie?
You don't have to. You can take that fire exit. Alarm might go off, but it's all right.
No, they disabled that years ago.
So in 1996, Walt Disney World hosted a 25th anniversary celebration. The home park for that celebration was obviously the Magic Kingdom. When Walt Disney World celebrated the new millennium in 1999, the home park was Epcot. Well, when it came time for Walt Disney's 100th birthday in 2001, they weren't going to have it at Animal Kingdom. So the obvious choice was the Disney MGM Studios. And so it was decided that many items in the park would be a celebration of Walt. They'd build a giant sorcerer's hat, which was supposed to be a double Ferris wheel outside of the park that somehow ended up right in front of the Chinese theater. But as part of all this, interestingly enough, several years earlier at the Magic Kingdom, there was an attraction called the Walt Disney Story. And the Walt Disney Story was closed in 1992, and there was a big uproar by many Disney fans and historians, upset that really the legacy of Walt Disney wasn't being shown to a new generation at the park, where it really felt like the proper place to do so. And so over the years, Michael Eisner tried many times over to prove to people that, yes, Walt is important in the parks and we want to celebrate his legacy, and maybe we don't need an attraction to do that. It's really the reason the partner statue was made. It was a way to ease the tension of there being a little less Walt in the parks. And Disneyland had the Walt Disney Story as well, and it was also removed, worth noting. But there people are happy about it because Lincoln came back, because they're weird out there. So anyway, like, we don't want Walt, we want Lincoln. Sure, whatever. And so several years later, they were still getting complaints, even though they released the Walt Disney Story in a half-hearted VHS version in the 90s that people could own. People still wanted some sort of celebration of Walt in the parks. They figured it's going to be the 100th anniversary. We still have some empty sound stages here at the studios. We have plenty of props and things to show. We could develop a short film. Let's make an exhibit, a walkthrough exhibit, and a film people can experience here at Hollywood Studios that celebrates the life of Walt Disney. And so Walt Disney One Man's Dream was born in 2001. And it's a really wonderful walkthrough exhibit through all of Walt's life and beyond, his legacy. And it has gone through several iterations over the years. There's been two versions of the film, one hosted by Michael Eisner, of course. And of course, there's the current version of the film as well. There's been several changes to the exhibit space over the years, modifications. At one point, they would sort of stop you in each room and you'd have to look around that room until the doors open and let you into the next room. That's no longer a thing. Several exhibits have changed. Mostly the end has changed many, many times. It was static for a number of years. Then it was the Hollywood Studios 25th anniversary exhibit for a while. Now it's a look forward to where Disney parks are going in the future. There's the new Fantasyland model. There's stuff from California Adventures redo. There's Shanghai Disneyland artwork. There's all kinds of stuff like that. So despite all of this, it has remained popular. People like something to walk through. It's a people eater. Disney fans love it to death. And then your average guest just meanders through, and a fair amount of them have a really wonderful time in there. And beyond that, it's even, it's pretty permanent now, and that it's sponsored by a major arm of the company. It's presented by D23. So Walt Disney One Man's Dream makes it all the way to moment number 11 on our countdown.
Mm-hmm. I personally think this is one of those entries where the fans got it pretty much right on the head. This is not an attraction that is going to appeal to everyone. Not everyone appreciates, I guess, the history behind the company itself. I think a lot of them might care more about just the product itself rather than where it came from or how it got to be where it is. And for that reason, they may not care about something like this. But for those who appreciate history, or those who appreciate the company, or those who are just, fans, this is a really, really great museum-esque exhibit. I was really surprised when I first stepped in there because I didn't even know it existed for a while after it had originally opened. Granted, I didn't really live in Orlando back then, but whatever. But it's a like I just think it's a really great exhibit. I like how they keep refreshing it with all the new stuff that the company is working on. And it's not just stuff that's occurring in Walt Disney World. And so I was able to convince my wife that we needed to go to Tokyo DisneySea based on the model that they have of Tokyo DisneySea in One Man's Dream. So, you know, it's a very effective way of letting people know what else is going on outside of perhaps just their the scope of their vacation. I wish that they would maybe kind of bring in some more stuff from the archives to extend, kind of add on to the history aspect. They do a good job of keeping the what's coming section of it fresh. I just wish that maybe they include some new stuff in the history. And what
we got a couple of new things in 2011 when they did the refurb. Not a ton, but...
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, there were a couple of film props and stuff like that.
The World's Fair display we got in the refurb, which I really love, which has the Small World facade model and Mr. Lincoln, and it's a neat piece. But you're right, it wasn't a tremendous amount of stuff.
Yeah, and it's not exactly something where you need to have a constant rotation of exhibits coming through there. I mean, because by and large, it is a chronological history of Walt Disney's life and experiences, and that's the main focus, and they do a good job of that. But, you know, make it something that allows for more repeatability, because unless you're a fan like us, you're probably not going to go through there maybe more than once or twice ever.
Yeah, which I think the purpose of this attraction has most definitely become, it's hot outside, the lines are long, where can we go?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I got it at number 11 as well, so nice job, fans.
So let me first say that I absolutely love this attraction.
In other words, David put this very high up.
Well, yeah, so I'll get to that. I love going in here. I don't get to spend as much time as I would like in here. I had it at number 15 just because I was trying to weigh the impact on the park itself versus my attachment to the attraction. So therefore, I may have discounted a little bit more. I'm always surprised that it's as popular as it is. You know, it feels like it was something that was built for me and maybe, you know, 20 other people. But I guess there are enough serious Disney fans out there that they really enjoy it. Plus, I think Zach said it, you know, the general public also gets some enjoyment out of this. It's not something that's entirely boring for them either. So I really appreciate that they put the amount of effort that they did into this. I mean, Disney has traditionally been, you know, kind of hesitant to do anything overtly historical within the parks. And the fact that this is entirely what it's about is the history of, you know, Walt Disney himself and how it impacted the company and the parks is really something that's they haven't gone that direction many times, and I'm glad they did here. I think to Zach's point about, you know, being able to reuse some of the archival stuff that they have that they tried out at D23 Expos, I would love for them to do a whole room where they actually do a rotation of archival items, because I think that would make the repeatability of this even better, because it would add a lot for those of us that do visit it quite often.
David said doo-doo.
Recycling gags.
So I put this at number 11, spot on where the listeners had it. I agree 100% with what David says. It would seem to be a very small target audience for this attraction. And you know, although a lot of people do go in, and maybe it's because it's hot outside and they're looking for a cool place, I definitely think that a lot of the people that go in are pleasantly surprised by what they find inside. You know, they linger, they look at stuff. Even people who aren't interested in Disney history really, I think, can spend some time in there and enjoy some of the models and the pictures and things like that. You know, this is something that's certainly historically significant for the company, But there are certainly things in this attraction that are historically significant from an American history perspective.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of a learning experience for some people. It's kind of a nostalgic experience for some people. It's kind of a both for crazy people like us. But it certainly is something that I think the company needed to do. And I'm very glad. In 2001, when this opened, I was happy. I totally did not expect it to last this long.
Yeah, I think many of us expected when 100 Years of Magic ended, it was going to go away. And it has not.
No. No. I'm very thankful, but I'm very surprised that it lasted this long. But it is significant. It's probably, like you said, the biggest display of the company's history in a theme park setting that's ever happened. And I think as I was and continue to be pleasantly surprised by the number of people that go through here, I hope the Disney company is also pleasantly surprised, and that's part of the reason why it's lasted this long.
Yeah. I think I have this at number 12, and a fair amount of my points have been made. The one last thing I want to say about this exhibit is something that a lot of people have said on this show, and I've heard a lot of people say when we go in here. I think when you go to Disneyland, there's a lot of Walt everywhere. Because that was his park. He lived in that park. He literally had an apartment. They spent nights in that park. It's hard to not find places where there's sort of that presence. And I think at Walt Disney World, he sort of walked around Magic Kingdom before anything was built. So he's seen the land. He's already been on the property. But it's not quite the same. And so it's nice that there definitely feels like there's a place where there's that presence through these props and things that were a part of his life and his life story. And I think for a lot of the people here that have that appreciation for the history of the company, the exhibit is a very nice addition. And you know, while at Disneyland, there are several places like that. I can think of the Opera House and things like that. Here it's that one place we have that's kind of like, you know, the Walt presence place, if you will. But anyway, yeah, I had a 12, so I had it just about where the listeners had it as well. Well, with that, that's going to do it for this particular edition of the Countdown. Next time, we're going to come back and we're going to start going through the top 10 moments in the 25 biggest moments in the history of Disney's Hollywood Studios.
This countdown of the 25 biggest moments in the history of Disney's Hollywood Studios was brought to you by WDW Celebrations and their Studio 25 commemorative event. Be sure to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the studios with fellow Disney fans on May 1st through the 4th, 2014, by registering today at www.wdwcelebrations.com. If you don't, you might regret it.
Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
We'll see you at the movies.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like that will do it for episode 319 of the WDW News Today podcast. As always, I'd like to thank you for tuning in. You make the show possible and worth producing each and every week. It's now time for the big finish, giving you all the useful information you'll need to know in the coming week. First of all, to contact us here at the show with any questions, suggestions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at wdwnewstoday@gmail.com. If you have not done so already, please leave us a review on iTunes. It's a great way to let others know about the show. Also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/WDWNT or at WDWNT. You also can like our fan page at facebook.com/WDWNewsToday. Don't forget about WDW News Today, the radio show, the only radio show in the world about Walt Disney World. That's every Saturday from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on AM 1520 WBZW in Orlando. And you can listen online at 1520WBZW.com. Coming up on next week's show, we're going to begin a series of segments celebrating the 50th anniversary of the New York World's Fair back in 1964-65 and the beginning of so many important things for the Walt Disney Company and the Disney parks in general. Celebration of It's a Small World, Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress, or Progress Land, whatever you want to call it. Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln and the Ford Magic Skyway. We're going to be celebrating those four extremely important attractions for a month starting next week, and we'll also be coming down to the wire on the final moments in our countdown of the 25 biggest moments in the history of Disney's Hollywood Studios as well. So it's going to be a couple of exciting weeks on the show as we get ready celebrating 50 years of the World's Fair and 25 years of Hollywood Studios. A lot of big anniversaries. So make sure you tune into that. Since I previewed the next few episodes of the show, that means that this particular one is over, and we can now end it with the corniest catchphrase in all of podcasting. That's going to do it for this week. We'll see you all next week. See ya real soon.
Thanks for listening to the WDW News Today podcast, and be sure to tune in again next week as we continue bridging the gaps between you and the Disney World. Also, be sure to check us out online at WDWNT.com. For everyone at WDWNT, this is Brian Summer saying goodnight, and have a pleasant tomorrow.
Anyway, babe, I gotta fly this coop and migrate back to Hollywood. My birds will call your birds. We'll do lunch.